You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 5th of August 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show, Israeli soldiers begin a withdrawal from Gaza, or what's left of it. A ceasefire appears to be holding, but how soon before we do all this again? Martin Plaut from the Institute of Commonwealth Studies and Isabel Hilton, editor of China Dialogue, join me to discuss this and the other big stories of the day. Also ahead,
I have access to 28% of my cerebral capacity.
I can feel every living thing.
Since when did you start writing Chinese?
Since an hour ago.
What happens when she reaches 100%?
I have no idea.
This summer's smash hit film Lucy starred a female action hero. But why are we still waiting, holding out, if you will, for a cinematic female superhero? We'll find out. We'll also catch up with our man in Cairo and review the latest dance music. That's all coming up on Midori House right now. But ahead of all that, Suzanne Chislett has the latest world news.
Twelve hours after a three-day ceasefire between Israelis and the Palestinian militant group Hamas began, it appears to still be holding. People living in Gaza have begun returning to their homes to see what they can save after weeks of shelling by Israeli defense forces. They've now withdrawn from the Palestinian territory. Officials in Gaza say more than 1,800 people have been killed since the operation began on July the 8th. Israel says 64 of its soldiers and three civilians have died. Lieutenant Colonel Peter Lerner is a spokesman for the Israeli Defense Forces.
The IDF has currently withdrawn all of its troops from the Gaza Strip, and we are in defensive positions outside of Gaza, outside the Strip. The next 72 hours are crucial to see what happens and what develops. We are taking a defensive stand. We are there in order to prevent further infiltration and further attacks from Gaza, originating from Gaza.
An American major general has been killed in an attack at a military academy in Afghanistan. The unnamed senior official was visiting the British-run site near Kabul when a man in Afghan uniform opened fire. Around 14 other people are thought to have been injured in the attack. Their nationalities are not yet known. The suspected gunman was shot dead at the scene. There are reports of intense fighting in the East Ukrainian city of Donetsk as government forces try to regain ground from pro-Russian rebels. The UN has released figures which show 730,000 people have fled the fighting, crossing from the region into Russia. Vincent Koschetel is from the UNHCR.
Over the last 3 weeks, we've seen the arrival of 1,200 persons per day. And those people are living with very little. Unlike those who had left from Crimea a couple of months ago, those people, most of them, had not prepared really their departure. They took a quick decision. Some of them were not even arrived with almost no belongings or got some of their belongings confiscated at checkpoints.
British Airways has suspended flights to and from Liberia and Sierra Leone because of the Ebola outbreak. It won't fly to the West African countries again until at least September, as the two nations and others tried to halt the spread of the disease. Around 900 people have now died in this outbreak. BA says the safety of its customers and crew is top priority. Meanwhile, a plane carrying a second American aid worker infected with Ebola in Liberia has now arrived at an airbase just outside Atlanta, Georgia. 59-year-old missionary Nancy Wrightbol will be hospitalized while doctors try to save her life. Kent Brantley, a 33-year-old doctor who was also infected with the virus, is already in isolation undergoing treatment there. Chinese state media says the country is investigating two Canadian nationals for suspected theft of state secrets. It names Kevin and Julia Garrett as being accused of stealing information about military and defense research. The State Security Bureau of Dandong City in northeastern China is investigating the case. Monocle's Hong Kong bureau chief, Aisha Spears, says it could be a tit-for-tat move.
It seems pretty hard to ignore the fact that this comes exactly a week after the allegations that the Canadian government made about Chinese hackers, who they say the Chinese hackers were highly sophisticated state-sponsored actors, and that is a direct attack at Beijing. They've lodged a protest with Beijing. Of course, the Chinese Foreign Ministry has denied this and instead accused Canada of making irresponsible accusations.
Nelson Mandela's second wife, Winnie, has launched a legal challenge to the will of the late anti-apartheid leader. Her lawyers have written to his estate, arguing that her children should be in charge of Mandela's ancestral home at Kunu in Eastern Cape. Winnie Madikizela Mandela got divorced from the former South African president in 1996. She says she bought the property while he was still behind bars. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thank you, Suzanne. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Coming up for 18.06 here in London. We'll be back right after this.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monocle 24 です.
London, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
You are listening to Midori House. The time here in London is 18.06, which will be 13.06 in New York City. Joining me now with their take on the news here in the studio is Martin Plout, a fellow at the Institute of Commonwealth Studies, and Isabel Hilton, editor of China Dialogue. Welcome to you both. We will start tonight in Gaza, where a 72-hour ceasefire was agreed by both sides from 800 hours local time this morning. Reports suggest that this time it is more or less holding as Israeli troops withdraw from Gaza, their mission of destroying Hamas's cross-border tunnel network and quite a lot of what was above it apparently complete. 4 weeks of fighting have left more than 1,800 Palestinians dead, mostly civilians, and 67 Israelis, almost all of them soldiers. Isabel, I'll ask you first. Both sides are inevitably going to attempt to declare some sort of victory. Are either of them right?
I think that's probably not the point. The Israelis have achieved a certain military objective, it would seem, but that's not a political victory. In fact, I think the political damage of this episode has been extreme. And you can't really tell until the negotiations start, but it would seem to me that there is more of an inclination to give Gaza and therefore Hamas a bit more breathing space, which Hamas would certainly claim as a victory.
Martin, how does this strike you as a win for either side? Because as Isabel was suggesting there, there's been political damage, especially to Israel. But from afar, it's hard to escape the sense of ghastly futility of this whole exercise on the grounds that both Israel and the people of Gaza are all going to have to live there afterwards.
Indeed. And, as one of my Palestinian friends said many years ago, in the end, we are all doomed to live with each other. And there is no alternative. The Israelis are not going to go away, although Hamas would like to, scrape them off the face of the Middle East and still believes in things like the Protocols of Zion and, is deeply anti-Semitic. The Israelis, frankly, would like to drive the Palestinians into the sea, but that isn't going to happen either. So, they both have completely antithetical objectives and aims and look at each other as total enemies. So at the moment, there's no real way forward.
Do you agree with Isabel's suggestion there that Israel has been badly politically damaged by this? There did seem to be... there's always been an element of, especially the European left, which is hostile to everything Israel does. But in this particular case, there was even quite harsh words from their usually steadfast ally in Washington.
Absolutely. And the other thing that's happened today, of course, is that Baroness Wasi here in the United Kingdom from the Foreign Office has resigned specifically over this, saying she can no longer support British policy on this. And what's particularly interesting is that a large number of her colleagues in the Conservative Party have said how sorry they are. There hasn't been an outcry against her. David Cameron, of course, has criticised her for resigning, said it was unnecessary. But people like Boris Johnson have come out saying, the Mayor of London has come out saying that he supports what she's done, or at least understands what she's done. So it is not just damaging to Israel. Of course, it's damaging to the Conservative Party because Banaswasi, being a Muslim, is sort of a poster girl for the Conservative Party, and there are a lot of seats that might ride on Muslim votes.
Isabel, leaving aside the obviously not inconsequential fact of the casualties and the astonishing damage to Gaza's already rickety infrastructure, aside, I guess, from the casualties of war, has anything actually changed from what the situation was 4 weeks ago?
I don't think anything's changed for the better. It's not the first time that the United States has rebuked Israel. Ronald Reagan, of all people, had also had occasion to ring Israel and rebuke it for its treatment of civilian populations in situations like this. I think that there's been what's changed? There's been a change in European attitudes, I think, pretty much across the board. And I think that although governments may not be acting out their disquiet, there's certainly a notable difference between views in America and views in Europe on this particular episode. There has been a rise in specific anti-Semitic incidents. And, I think that anti-Semitism, gives cover to Israel, and Israel gives cover to anti-Semitism. This behaviour, which is the behaviour of a government and a military, is now, as soon as you describe it in terms of the state of Israel or if it's feeding anti-Semitism in Europe, it becomes, a no-go area. And it's very hard to advance that conversation. I think that's a negative. In terms of what's changed, I think this is a miserable conflict that's gone on for 50 years. And I think that at best we'll see some relaxation for Gaza. A new generation of people who hate Israel will have been bred in this conflict, new generations of grievance. And I can't quite see what's going to stop another round of this in 5 or 6 years' time.
You talked there about the extraordinarily rancorous and indeed unsavoury aspect of some of the protest against Israel. Just wondering what you both think about how much this time, in this particular iteration of the conflict, it's been amplified by the way the modern media is, and by social media in particular, because there has been some extraordinarily poisonous and nasty stuff traded in that forum. And I'm just wondering, do you think both sides or either side actually tunes this stuff out, or does it have an effect? Does this kind of constant clamour add to the frenzy on both sides? Martin, what do you think?
Well, I think that there are some elements, particularly in Israel, which I must say I find it particularly reprehensible, because in a sense they are, it is a Western democracy, and you'd have thought they might know better. Just to give you two instances. One is the situation where you have settlers sitting on hillsides in comfy armchairs, looking at the bombardment as a sort of nightly, little fun thing to watch, and the shells exploding inside Gaza. I mean, that is sickening. These are people who suffer, whose parents, suffered in the Holocaust. I mean, this is, and yet they're quite happy to see other people treated in this way. And I find that absolutely reprehensible. The other thing is that the statistic, 95% of Israelis think this is fine. This is okay. And I think they have lost touch with the rest of the world, which thinks it is absolutely abhorrent. Now, I mean, that doesn't mean that I think that Hamas is right or their views are any more acceptable. But, when you are the powerful one in this situation, more is expected of you. And frankly, the Israelis are behaving despicably.
Isabel, final thought from you on this. What have you made of the tone of the media coverage and, I guess, the social media coverage?
Well, I think that the social media coverage does amplify the trading of insults, and that narrows the space for a reasoned discussion of Israeli behaviour. And I've been very struck by, certainly in the media coverage that I've seen, there is huge indignation at the treatment of civilians in Palestine. But there is always space given, and more space given, to the Israeli spokesman, who always justifies it in the same terms. And we just cannot seem to get beyond this killing while crying approach that Israel has, describing the deaths of civilians as a tragedy as though they had no agency in it. And I think that, you know, the discussion somehow has to get back to the agency of the state, the laws of war, proportionality. And those things have been lost in the trading of insults.
Well, I wish that I thought there was any chance that we wouldn't come back to this story again at some point in the near future. I rather suspect we will have every opportunity. We shall move along for the moment to Washington, which begins hosting the first ever US-Africa Leaders Summit today. Nearly 50 African leaders are gathered, many of whom might be wondering why it has taken President Barack Obama so long to host such a gathering. In 2008, I remember from my own travels there, Africa was electrified by the idea that the son of a Kenyan economist would inhabit the White House. But aside from Nelson Mandela's funeral, Obama has only visited sub-Saharan Africa twice. Martin Platt, I'll start with you first. Should Obama have done more in Africa, with Africa, for Africa? Or was there a sense that he didn't actually want to be seen as being that guy?
I think you've hit the nail on the head. I think that's precisely the point, that he didn't want to be totally associated with his African heritage. I mean, after all, people suggested he wasn't even born in the United States, despite all the evidence that he was. So I think he was very, very careful about that. Look, you know, it's always going to be low. Africa is always going to be low down on any American president's agenda. I mean, President Bush remarkably did extremely well on Africa and is actually quite well regarded
in Africa.
Indeed,
yeah.
But, you know, I don't really hold this against against President Obama. Africa in the end gets on quite happily by itself or unhappily by itself sometimes. But really what set this all off was the Chinese. The Chinese set the tone for all of this by inviting every African leader, and they've held a number of African summits. And I think the Americans felt, hang on, we're slipping behind in the race for influence in Africa. And so there they're coming and hosting one.
Is this, Isabel, another scramble for Africa? Chinese trade with Africa is estimated at somewhere near $200 billion annually. The United States, $85
billion. Absolutely.
The United States realizing they may have missed the boat.
Yes, I think that they're realizing that their view of Africa, which is largely about security or problems or ethnic conflict or a place where trouble comes, that if you read what's being said about this summit by the administration, it's really, you know, about the notion of opportunity in Africa. A lot of that opportunity has been created by Chinese engagement and you know, the economic opportunity that it's given to Africa. But the Chinese are pretty well established. I mean, not only are they doing a lot of trade, they're building huge amounts of infrastructure, and some of it unwise and possibly not good for Africa, but they're giving enormous sports stadia, and you know, they've been around in Africa quietly and persistently and in quite large numbers for quite a long time now, for 8-10 years, and it's had a big impact.
Martin, there's a few significant non-invitees on the guest list. Zimbabwe, Sudan, Eritrea, the Central African Republic, all not invited. The latter, of course, possibly because they couldn't think of who in the Central African Republic you would invite if you were trying to invite someone
Indeed.
In charge there at the moment.
And don't forget the poor little Western Sahara.
Indeed, and Western Sahara. Any surprises there? And also, should Museveni have been left off the guest list as well, following Uganda's sort of bizarre legislative pogrom against gay people?
Well, indeed. But what about Kenyatta from Kenya, who was invited when he's wanted by the International Criminal Court?
A fair point.
Supposed to be standing there. So, you know, there. But I mean, you know, if you started looking seriously at the credentials of most African leaders, would you have people from Equatorial Guinea, Angola, or even, shall we say, South Africa, since after all, you know, President Zuma still has a whole string of corruption allegations hanging over his head. So, I mean, you know, you've got to have the bar fairly low in Africa, otherwise you wouldn't have any invitees at all. But, you know, it is wonderful that there is now more competition for Africa's attention. I'm delighted the Chinese are there. I wouldn't be quite as positive as Isabel is about their impact. But, you know, it's wonderful that there's now, you know, Africa is being courted by many parties. But there is one thing that the Americans bring to the table that nobody else does, really, apart from the French, and that is boots on the ground. They have troops in Africa, and they're doing, frankly, the work that African leaders desperately want done. I mean, who else is trying to fight Boko Haram? Who else is trying to fight Islamists in Somalia? Only the Americans. And this is really a crucial role that they're playing, and nobody else is doing it, as I say, apart from the French.
Well, on that semi-optimistic note, we will take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Muller, with my guest Martin Plowden and Isabel Hilton. When we return, we will be discussing Ukraine and the reasons Australia is less keen than it previously might have been for some of its people to go to certain places.
What designs will you be wearing next season? How will architecture change the face of your city? And which redesign will affect the paper you pick up?
It's very strange. It's like two triangles and two squares more. But I think that's a stimulus for the architect.
The kerning can take 5 times as long as actually designing the letter forms, which seems fairly brutal.
Is it going to perform? Is it going to stay the same? Is it going to be the same? That's normal anxiety.
Good design improves our lives. If you want to find out how, join me, Monocle's design editor Tom Morris, every Tuesday on Monocle 24.
And welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Still with me are Martin Plowden from the Institute of Commonwealth Studies and Isabel Hilton from China Dialogue. Now, almost as if concerned that nobody was paying them enough attention, Russia has chosen this moment to conduct a large-scale military exercise along its border with Ukraine, of all places. More than 100 aircraft are involved, and reports suggest a build-up of 45,000 troops and 1,500-odd armoured vehicles. Isabel, I'll ask you first. They wouldn't. Really, would they?
I wouldn't be surprised if they did. It depends what happens in Donetsk. I mean, if they feel that they have to conduct a humanitarian mission to rescue Russian citizens or whatever the excuse would be, I think they might. And, you know, they've tested out the will of the West. Who's going to go in there and stop them?
You would think, though, at least I thought, and we did talk about this on the radio at the time, that after the MH17 incident, I did possibly, well, obviously, optimistically imagine that the entire rebellion would die of embarrassment at that point. Martin, what is Russia's continued interest in stirring things up in Ukraine?
Well, look at it this way. How did the Americans react when the Russians tried to put missiles on Cuba?
Cuba was an awful lot closer to America than Ukraine.
Really?
Yeah, geographically.
I'm not sure from their point of view that it is very much further away. And I mean, it's particularly as it threatens their Black Sea bases. If this was happening if the Russians were doing this in Canada, how do you think the Americans would react? I think those are the only questions you have to ask yourself. This is geopolitics. This is their backyard. They're not going to allow it to get out of control, and it looks as if the eastern half of Ukraine is likely to come under Ukrainian control, and I think this is something they're not prepared to see happen.
Russia, though, if Russia was going to back out, though, wouldn't they just have backed out by now and let this thing die away? Because the rebellion is done without Russian assistance, isn't it?
Yes, but, you know, President Putin has put his credibility on the line over this one. And, he's been backed into a corner. It's cost a lot already in terms of his friends being, you know, sanctions against him. And sanctions are increasing all the time. It is costing them money and it's costing them reputation. And, you know, having lost all that, why not go in and take it?
Isabel, is Russia now at the point that it's gripped by that phenomenon of sunk costs, that it's invested so much in this and sustained so much damage that it feels like it has to be able to come away with something it can call a victory?
Well, I think it would be very hard for Putin to back down at this point. I mean, if you look at what Russia has been saying about this whole situation over the past few months, I mean, it is, you know, extraordinarily divergent from the coverage in the West, and certainly they have, you know, made it a justified Putin exercise. And if there were a reversal and the Ukrainians are advancing on Donetsk, I think that it's quite likely that the Russians would feel that they had to come to the defense of, you know, what they would, you know, still describe as freedom fighters and Russians and freedom fighters. And, you know, there's a constant stream of propaganda on Russian television about innocent innocent Russians fleeing fascists in the Ukraine. They have characterized the Ukrainian government as a neo-Nazi government. I can't see how they're going to allow anything to slip in terms of the gains that they've already made.
And as you said, Isabel, of course, they are not part of NATO. So Ukraine has no guarantee from anybody. And I can't see I can't see anyone putting soldiers in to stop it. So, well, then what's not to like as far as President Putin's concerned?
We will look finally at Australia. And among the foreign legions fighting with various Islamist militias across the Middle East are roughly, it is believed, 150 young men from Australia who've made the interesting choice to forswear life in one of the richest, safest and nicest countries on earth in order to impose Sharia law at gunpoint upon terrified foreigners. So Australia now plans to pass travel laws which will make it a criminal offence to travel to certain areas without a valid reason. This stuff always strikes me as a bit weird when Australia reacts with panic and terror to anything. I come from Australia. It is, you know, it's the luckiest, most fortunate country there has ever been, ever. It has almost nothing to fear from anything but its own environment. Is this an overreaction, Isabel?
I think it's a very odd reaction. And, you know, I looked at this. Of course, I haven't seen the list of places that you're not allowed to travel to if you're an Australian. But, you know, there's a very long tradition in a lot of countries of young men going and fighting in foreign causes. You know, from the Spanish Civil War, for instance, they weren't criminalized when they came back. In Central America, I knew a number of you know, people from Britain or from other parts of Europe who were fighting with the rebels in Salvador, for instance, or doctors who were going and, you know, assisting the rebels in Salvador. If you go to a graveyard in Srinagar, you know, Britain has a huge Kashmiri population, you will find graves of young men from Wolverhampton and you know, other towns in the Midlands. And, you know, there has been a long tradition whereby, you know, if you feel strongly about a cause, you can go and fight in it. And unless you're bringing that back, unless you're fighting against your own country, most countries have taken a fairly relaxed view of this. Now, clearly, there is jihad and jihad. You know, there are causes and causes, and some causes are extremely local. The Kashmiri cause would certainly be described as terrorism by India, but it hasn't been brought back to Britain. And so there are causes you can go and fight in which have no impact at all, for instance, on Australia. So I think it is odd, but I guess we'd have to look at the list.
Martin, I tend to the view myself, and I may be naive and missing something, that Australia could just say, well, you know, if and when they come back, we can arrest them, and if they don't come back, they won't be missed. Is Australia being unnecessarily paranoid about this?
I think it probably is, but, you know, one shouldn't forget that, I mean, Isabel's quite right. Of course, people did go off and fight in the Spanish Civil War. But, you know, the Secret Service here in Britain did keep a very careful watch on them when they came back. So they were worried about what the implications of, but they weren't criminalised, as you say, that which is very different. And, you know, people from Britain went and fought in South Africa many times. I mean, for example, you had Brits who went and fought on the Boer side in the Boer War. You had, you know, Brits and Americans who did the same. And then Brits who in fact, went and fought against apartheid.
There are foreign citizens serving the Israeli Defence Forces.
Indeed,
well, there are foreign
moment.
Doctors in Gaza. You know, if they're treating Hamas as they might well, you know, do they count?
Yeah, exactly.
Is this one of those things that just needs to be treated on a case-by-case basis, then?
Well, I can see the point in keeping an eye on people because, after all, as Isabel said, there is jihad and jihad, and you don't want people coming back thoroughly radicalized who are then going to see the whole of the West as their enemy. A state has to guard its citizens against danger, and that is, you know, it's one of its central responsibilities, and that clearly is something they have to guard against. But, I mean, to criminalize them necessarily for going to places, it just seems like an overreaction.
Isabel, 13 years now, more or less, since September 11th. Have we learnt any more about why people do this, why people would leave a pleasant, secure, safe, democratic Western country and take up the, you know, not, I suspect, comfortable or pleasant life of a jihadi?
Well, I think it's all about the quest for meaning in life, if you really want my opinion. I think that, you know, at a certain age, people are very vulnerable to this. It's an age when people become, you know, if they're going to join religious cults, they join religious cults. Most of them leave 5 or 6 years later. But there are, you know, this is a time in life when people want to signify. And it's pretty significant to go and fight a jihadi cause.
I mean, just to quote Prince Charles, whom I don't do very often, he many years ago actually pointed out that not having much of a threat as a young person is quite a difficult thing to deal with.
Young people, they are a dreadful pest. We will have to leave it there. Martin Plowd and Isabel Hilton, thank you very much for joining us. You're listening to Midori House.
From London
to New York
to Tokyo
to Shanghai
to Berlin
to Tel Aviv
to Buenos Aires
to Toronto,
to Amsterdam,
all around the world. This is Monocle 24.
Lots still to come in the second half of today's Midori House. We will speak to our man in Cairo, meet cinema's first full-fledged female superhero, possibly. And we'll talk dance music with the producer, Phil Meissen. But before we get started on all that, here's Suzanne Chislett with the world news headlines.
Thank you, Andrew. More than 12 hours after a three-day ceasefire between Israelis and the Palestinian militant group Hamas began, it appears to still be holding. People living in Gaza have begun returning to their homes to see what they can save after weeks of shelling by Israeli defense forces. An American major general has been killed in an attack at a military academy in Afghanistan. The unnamed senior official was visiting the British-run site near Kabul when a man in Afghan uniform opened fire. There are reports of fresh, intense fighting in the East Ukrainian city of Donetsk as government forces try to regain ground from pro-Russian separatists. The UN says 730,000 people have fled the fighting in the region in recent weeks, crossing over the border into Russia. And British Airways has suspended flights to and from Liberia and Sierra Leone because of the Ebola outbreak. It won't fly to the West African countries until at least September, as the two nations and others try to halt the spread of the disease. Those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Suzanne. Welcome back to Midori House live here on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Muller. It's time now to check in with one of our correspondents around the world. Tonight, it's the turn of Cairo and the turn of Joseph Dana. Joseph, welcome to the programme.
Thank you.
Egypt, obviously, where you are, has been a key player in the crisis in Gaza over the last few weeks. It brokered or helped mediate the ceasefire, which appears to be holding. From the position you're in Cairo, how has the fighting in Gaza shaken up the diplomatic picture in the Middle East?
Well, it's shaken up the diplomatic picture to a severe degree. Effectively, we've seen that Egypt has emerged as really a less credible mediator in terms of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. The Palestinians have lost a lot of faith in the Egyptian regime under General Abdel Fattah el-Sisi in terms of how he's able to represent their desires and their wishes in how the conflict is shaping up. Additionally, we've seen a real lack of presence on the Egyptian street in terms of protesters in support of Gazans and then the situation, Palestinians in general. And so we're looking at a completely new Egypt, as it were, in terms of how they're able to really represent their position as one of the most important countries in the Arab world. And I think that as this ceasefire takes hold and the dust really does begin to settle in Gaza, we're going to see a very interesting new kind of diplomatic regional picture in which Egypt will be representing this kind of push towards a lot of the Israeli demands in the conflict, representing some of the interests of Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, and Jordan, while Turkey and Qatar are going to be on that oppositional front, kind of supporting Hamas and trying to rally up that kind of Palestinian card. And this is really going to dictate how this region looks for the next months and probably years.
You talked there about how Turkey had been much more demonstrative in its support for the Palestinians than most Arab countries, which is certainly the case. As far as it's possible to tell, and I know he has a presidential election coming up on Sunday, and you rarely lose votes in that part of the world by beating up on Israel, but where is Erdogan going with this?
It's a very good question. The Turkish foreign policy at this point is really kind of in tatters. You know, the Turkish foreign minister quite triumphantly announced this zero problems with neighbors strategy just a couple of years ago, and now it's turned into kind of zero problems and zero friends as well. And so the Turkish prime minister, in his election campaign to become Turkey's first directly elected president, has really been drumming up this Palestinian card. It's very good for the internal kind of Turkish consumption to cast Erdogan as this Palestinian figure, as this kind of guardian of Palestinian rights. But when push comes to shove, the relationship between Turkey and Israel is still very strong. 2014 will probably be one of the biggest years in terms of bilateral trade between the two countries. And so that relationship, at least the economic relationship, is going to remain. And so it really begs the question as to what exactly Erdogan is thinking. Is this actually going to be a real strategy in which Erdogan could emerge as a kind of new Sunni leader in the Middle East, kind of forging ahead with this very militantly pro-Palestinian policy and strategy? Or is this just political, hollow political rhetoric that's designed to win this election, and yet none of the actual systemic features of the relationship between Turkey and Israel and Turkey and the rest of the region is going to change? And I think it's probably going to be the latter. We'll see as the election dust kind of settles in Turkey in the coming months.
You mentioned there the lack of protests in Egypt about the fighting in Gaza. There's also been a notable lack of protests in Egypt about domestic economic concerns. Sisi has announced a series of cuts to various things as well as tax hikes. Why aren't people protesting? Is Egypt's economy actually recovering?
Egypt's economy is not recovering. Actually, as I speak to you right now, we're in the middle of a power outage, and power outages are happening very frequently in Cairo. And so you can actually physically kind of feel how bad the Egyptian economy is at this point. But the fact that there were not widespread protests against Sisi when he announced just 2 weeks ago that fuel prices would be increased and the price of, hard commodities like bread and flour were going to rise, it really demonstrates that the Egyptian people are ready to give this guy a shot, as it were. And he quite carefully said that when he announced these price cuts, saying, my mission here is to save the nation, and this is what it's going to take. And so we have to keep in mind that there is a fair bit of money coming into Egypt, especially from the Gulf countries. And that ties into what we were talking about earlier in terms of Egypt kind of taking this very militantly anti-Hamas position in the Gaza conflict. And so I think that there's enough money coming into the country that will allow for some sort of change to happen. But as we look at it right now, Egypt is in the midst of a very serious economic crisis that's really just a kind of hangover of the last couple of years of systemic political violence that has really engulfed this country.
And finally, Joseph, and I guess it's a story which sort of ties in to what we started with, a enduring sort of signifier of the strange friendship relationship, call it what you will, between Egypt and Israel. Air Sinai, it was suspended for 10 days or so during the conflict. They're now flying again. It does seem surprising, weirdly, that all things considered, you can get on a direct flight from Cairo to Tel Aviv.
It's really one of those fantastic stories in the Middle East. Air Sinai is an airline that is owned by Egypt Air, the national flag carrier. And as part of the Camp David protocols between Israel and Egypt, one of the facets was that there would be a direct flight at least a couple of times a week between Cairo and Tel Aviv. And Air Sinai runs this route. It runs it with an aging 737 that's actually unmarked. It almost looks like an extradition plane of some sort. And this was one of the airlines that actually kept flying until the very last moment during this recent Gaza conflict when the missiles were falling very close to Tel Aviv. And it was one of the airlines that kind of resumed flights very quickly. And there has been some comments in the Israeli press that just demonstrate that the, you know, the Egyptians are very interested in sending a direct message to Hamas that its alliance is really, you know, shifting towards the Israelis, and it's going to be operating this flight, you know, as much as possible. Now, I've actually taken this flight, and there's not that many people that actually fly this route. You can't book the ticket online. You have to go to a very odd office and buy an actual paper ticket, which is quite novel. But it does exist, and it's, you know, one of these just very odd facets of this landscape that we see in the Middle East, where alliances, you know, kind of come and go, and they result in these very, very odd, you know, kind of connection points over the skies of the Middle East.
Joseph Dana, thank you very much. That was Joseph Dana in Cairo. Up next, we'll be welcoming the arrival of the female cinematic superhero. Stay tuned to find out more. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
If you're after a soundtrack to your working day, look no further than Monocle 24's Globally Minded playlist. We play the very best upbeat music from around the world, around the clock, whether that's jazz from Japan, pop from Paris, house from Hamburg, or soul from Seoul. It's all picked by our team and presented by our editors. So get lost in music with Monocle 24's playlist right here, day and night, on Monocle 24.
And welcome back to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller. Now, compose, if you will, a list of the great fictional superheroes. Superman, Batman, Spider-Man, the X-Men, a pattern emerges. Reports suggest, however, that this particular glass ceiling may be smashed, possibly literally, given the context. Sony are rumoured to be planning a superhero movie led by a female character for possible release in 2017. Well, joining me now to talk about why it's taken this long is pop culture journalist and Yahoo Movies reporter Gwyn Watkins. Gwyn, welcome to the show. I was trying to think, because I am a nitpicking pedant, if this really would represent the first. Where do you stand on Wonder Woman, Catwoman, Lara Croft, etc.?
I think they're all certainly superheroes. And there have been a lot of strong women in movies, and certainly women like Katniss Everdeen in the Hunger Games movies, who shoots arrows and is kind of her own superhero. But there have been very few comic book superhero movies led by women. And the most recent ones are probably Elektra, which was a spinoff of Daredevil. I believe that was 2005. And Catwoman in 2004, and both those movies were notorious bombs, and really no one has tried it since.
Well, you mentioned Catwoman, the 2004 Halle Berry vehicle, which was, of course, by absolutely common consent, total rubbish. Was Hollywood scared off by the response to that, do you think?
I think they were. One thing that's important to keep in mind when we're talking about movies from 10 years ago is that I don't think Hollywood had really cracked the code on what makes a superhero movie yet. You know, now you have all these superhero movies with these huge openings. I mean, they've really figured out what people want. And all the superhero movies were kind of experiments up until the last few years when the studios, Marvel in particular, have really gotten on the pulse of it. But I think there is that precedent set by those where people still think of those as the movies that did badly that no one wanted to see.
So what do we know about this alleged female superhero vehicle idea character being plotted for 2017?
Not very much. Sony has not officially announced it. This was a report in a trade magazine, Deadline Hollywood. But reportedly they're planning a female-led superhero movie for 2017. Now, Sony does not own the rights to very many comic book superhero characters, but they do own the Spider-Man franchise. So speculation is that it might be Spider-Woman or another hero connected to Spider-Man.
On the sort of spider theme, weren't there suggestions or aren't there suggestions that Black Widow might become a thing?
Absolutely. I'm a big advocate of a Black Widow movie, and Marvel Studios would be the studio to release that, and the president, Kevin Feige, gave an interview recently saying that he wants to do a female-led superhero movie, but the timing just hasn't been right, and he doesn't want to launch a whole new franchise. But the thing about Black Widow is it wouldn't be a whole new franchise. See, this is a well-established character who's starred already in three movies, She's been in Iron Man. She's been in Captain America. She's been in The Avengers. People love her. And as Scarlett Johansson just proved with Lucy, she can certainly open a movie.
Do you think it's important that if there's going to be this, you know, imagined breakthrough female superhero character, that it should be an entirely new thing? Because if it is a Spider-Woman, that's going to seem like kind of a sidekick, isn't it?
Well, the thing about the Spider-Woman character is that she's not... she's actually not particularly connected to Spider-Man. That's kind of a weird case in the comics. So she really is sort of her own hero. But you're right, there would be probably some audience trouble differentiating Spider-Woman and Spider-Man. It would probably be better if out the gate it wasn't something like Spider-Woman or She-Hulk, that it could be a character who can easily be identified on her own merits.
Well, as this character is currently a blank slate, are there any particular qualities you would like her to have?
I think the most important thing when creating a female hero is that she's strong in the things that make her a woman, that she's not interchangeable with male heroes. I think audiences, men and women, really want to see a complicated, interesting character, not just somebody who can kick a lot of butts.
Gwyn Watkins, thank you very much for joining us. It's time now on Midori House for a bit of music, sticking seamlessly with the theme established by the previous item. It's Hero Takes a Fall by the Bangles. From their outrageously underrated 1984 debut album, All Over the Place, The Bangles with Hero Takes a Fall. You are listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24, coming up to the end of the show, which means it is time to review the best, occasionally the worst, in the world of television, cinema, theatre, books, music, etc. Today we are talking music. And before Ibiza became the neon-tinged collision of brand celebrities and sunburnt tourists it is known as nowadays, it was a far more wild and free-thinking place. In bars like Cafe Mambo and clubs like Amnesia, open-minded DJs played anything but dance music to a crowd of hippies, millionaires, drug addicts, and probably Grace Jones, a mix of Afrobeat, Europop, goth-friendly guitar music, and even Chris Rea. Today's guest music reviewer was there setting the pace. Phil Meeson is a London-based DJ, producer, and record collector playing an eclectic mix of music in bars and on dance floors around the world. He sat down with Monocle's Paul Noble to talk tunes.
Phil Meeson, welcome along to Monocle.
Thank you, Paul.
The sun is out. It's suitably hot here in London today.
It's a lovely day.
And you've brought some suitably summery music.
Yeah, four kind of fairly random tracks, but all good.
Now, it's the question every DJ hates to be asked, but how would you summarise your style of what you play?
That is very difficult. I guess it's, you can't really just say good music, because that's a lot of stuff, but I wouldn't even say summery music. Some of it isn't. Anything from house, disco, there's a link to it all, that it's all kind of has a certain style and shape to it that I just like.
And how much of your time is spent sort of looking for music, DJing, producing? What sort of proportions?
I buy more records than ever now. Actually, now with obviously the internet and you've had these smartphones, you can go onto Discogs and buy things very quickly.
They make it too easy for you, don't they?
It's too easy.
Yeah, it's a killer. All right, well, let's listen to your first pick. This is John Lucien. Give us a bit of background on him.
John Lucien was, he's passed away now, but he was like a famous soul singer who did a few hits, Would You Believe on Me, that I think were big on the sort of jazz dance scene. I've heard Dave Henley from Pressure Drop play it about, 20 odd years ago by a lake somewhere, and it just sounded pretty phenomenal.
Well, it's a shame to leave it there because there's so much of it, but
it's pretty good.
Very, very spiritual Fender Rhodes stuff from John Lucien there. Your next track. It's one of those 80s bands who've sort of been a bit maligned, and the name is a bit of a sort of code word for some of the excesses of 80s music, and that's the Cocteau Twins.
Oh, yeah. I used to play these a lot in Ibiza, especially this album, The Four Calendar Cafe. They did another track as well called Pandora. It's get played there a lot in Ibiza, but the whole album is just fantastic.
So you're reclaiming this from the goths?
Yeah, no, I think music before the internet, you came and put it a bit more randomly. People would just say, listen to this, things would turn up. It wasn't all there, a fingertip, a click of a button.
That just makes me want to have a nice cocktail by a pool with a fan on me.
I've got a fan here if you...
Okay. Yeah. If it's Monocle branded, I think we're all right. Let's stay in the 80s with another pick of yours, which is Furniture.
Yeah.
They had a hit, didn't they?
Brilliant Mind was the kind of fairly gloomy hit they had, I guess. But
and so how did you find this?
This was actually, it sounds like, you know, you should have heard it in 88 or something, but I heard it at The Loft in New York. David Mancuso played it, and I hadn't heard it before then, and it just sounded pretty outstanding.
From a time where pop music wasn't afraid to be sort of quite stripped down and homemade.
Yeah.
And also really melodramatic and preposterous.
It gets even more melodramatic and shouty, that record.
I can see how that would be for a very discerning dance floor.
Yeah. But it does work, trust me.
Not one for the Christmas parties.
No.
Let's end on one of your productions.
Yes.
This is you under the name of Cantoma.
Yep, this is a track I did with Bing Jialing on vocals, came out last year.
And who's Bing Jialing?
Quinn, based in New York, is a singer-songwriter, released a lot of stuff, solo stuff. Also is with Phenomenal Handclap Band and is now with Pacwa, along with Paul Murphy on Claremont 56.
And just before we finish, where would we find you DJing in the next few months?
I'm going to New York tomorrow. Then I'm heading over to Croatia, the Garden Bar, and I've also been doing a Friday residency in the Red Market in Old Street. The last party is August 29th with Leo Mess, the original DJ from Amnesia.
And are we going to find you in Ibiza at any point
yes,
this summer?
Yes, I'll be there September 13th at Boutique Hostel Las Salinas, along with Hugh Herrera, Izzet Blerick, Recordings, and Dean Smith.
Lovely. Phil Meissen, thanks very much.
Thank you very much, Paul.
That's all we have time for on today's edition of Midori House. My thanks in particular to our special guests, Martin Platt and Isabel Hilton. Today's show was produced by Marcus Hippie, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Chiara Ramella. Our studio manager was Joel Church. Next up, after the headlines, Monocle's Design Show, Section D with Tom Morris at 2200, the Monocle Daily with me and Marcus Hippie. I'll be back with Midori House as well at the same time tomorrow at 1800 London time. But for this edition, it's goodbye and thanks for listening.
London.
Tao Beijing.
This is Monocle 24.
Nach Amsterdam.
A Bogota.
To Hong Kong.
All around the world.
This is Monocle 24.
Rolex is responsible for several landmark innovations in watchmaking, including the Oyster, the first waterproof wristwatch, and the perpetual rotor self-winding mechanism. Crafted from the finest raw materials and assembled with scrupulous attention to detail, Oyster Perpetual watches benefit from Rolex's cutting-edge technology and extensive expertise. Epitomizing the values that have made the brand world famous, Oyster Perpetual watches symbolize a way of life, a benchmark for style.